Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Theory of Haunting by Sarah Monette. Narrated by Matt Godfrey. The current owner of Third Hop Scarp claims that the name is a contraction of Third Hope, but this idea is etymologically dubious in the extreme. Still improbable, but far more likely, is the local explanation. That if you fall off the escarpment, you reach the bottom in three hops. Tragedy and scandal have surrounded the house for 80 years since it was built by the occultist Zenobia Webster Tull, and given the choice, I would have preferred to have nothing to do with it. However. 1. One Tuesday afternoon, Dr. Starkweather, the director of the Samuel Mather Parrington Museum, called me to his office, where he bade me sit, and then unnerved me horribly by staring at me, frowning, turning a pen over and over in his thick fingers. Finally, he made a curious sound, half sigh, half snort, and said, "I've just returned from Byzantium." I said. Byzantium was the name of the Parrington mansion, where Samuel Mather Parrington's daughters, widowed Blanche and spinster Griselda, still lived. Its appearance in Dr. Starkweather's conversation was never a propitious omen. Dr. Starkweather's baleful glare moved from me to the portrait of Samuel Mather Parrington that dominated his office. "It seems that Miss Parrington has become involved with the circle of Marcus Oleander." "Oh, dear." "Precisely, Mr. Booth," said Dr. Starkweather. Marcus Oleander, for such was the name under which he presented himself, had been in the newspapers rather a lot in the last few years. He had purchased the house at Third Hop Scarp, announcing it to have been the dying wish of his mentor, T. Zacharias Tull, that he, Oleander, inherit the house and the Tull legacy. He had started an esoteric order called the Order Aurori Eterni, which seemed to be mostly a society club for dilettantes in the occult, but was definitely a means for Marcus Oleander to promote his own learning, wisdom, and alleged occult power. He was always willing to say something outrageous to newspaper men if it meant he would get in the newspapers. "Mrs. Crowe is not pleased," Dr. Starkweather said grimly. "She believes that Marcus Oleander is nothing more than a confidence man. She wishes the museum to investigate Mr. Oleander's occult claims, and she would prefer that we find evidence of charlatanry that she can present to her sister to persuade her to drop the connection." Convincing the eternally credulous Griselda Parrington that Marcus Oleander was not what he said he was sounded a little like trying to level a mountain with nothing more than a spoon. "But how can the museum possibly—" "Mrs. Crowe understands from her sister that Oleander is in need of someone to catalogue his library. I said you would be happy to oblige." Nothing could have been farther from the truth. I hate travel, hate meeting strangers, and am most dreadfully bad at any kind of social interaction. I yelped and scrambled for defense. Dr. Starkweather, I don't...
"Mrs. Crowe asked for you," Dr. Starkweather said even more grimly. "Specifically."
While it was Griselda Parrington who interested herself most keenly in the business of the museum, it was Blanche Parrington Crowe who controlled the Parrington estate. And the Parrington estate was still, nearly 30 years after Samuel Mather Parrington's death, the museum's principal benefactor. I have worked as an archivist at the Parrington Museum for 15 years, specializing in books on the occult and other arcane subjects. My job has brought me into contact with the supernatural far more often than I would like, but it is my only passion, and I cannot give it up. "When is Mr. Oleander expecting me?" Short of tendering my resignation on the spot, there was nothing else I could say. The last owner of Third Hopscarp, before Marcus Oleander, had been John Aloysius Cathcart, and on the train trip from the city to the nearest station to Third Hopscarp in Pittmanville, I considered his sanguinary history. I had not known him personally, but he had been an acquaintance of my guardian's, stigmatized as parvenu and pushing, but a valuable business associate nevertheless. He had bought Third Hopscarp when T. Zacharias Tull had died, intestate and, as it transpired, massively in debt. In the last years of my adolescence, I had listened to unending speculation about what had happened to the famous Tull fortune and how T. Zacharias could possibly have squandered it all. J. A. Cathcart was regarded with a mixture of revulsion and grudging approbation for having taken advantage of the situation with such promptness and vigor. People made uneasy jokes about the ghost of T. Zacharias expressing his opinion, but nothing of the sort happened. Even Mrs. Cathcart, who had reportedly been very nervous about the house, admitted that there was nothing wrong with it at all. Until there was. But by the time anyone knew, it was already far too late. Just past midnight on the 8th of August, the year I turned 17, the servants of Third Hopscarp were woken by screams. Terrible screams, their testimony at the trial agreed. A woman's voice, screaming in terror and mortal agony. And under that, a roaring noise, more like an animal than anything human. That roaring continued after the screams could no longer be heard. Continued for at least half an hour. And when it finally stopped, it was nearly half an hour more before the terrified housekeeper and equally terrified gardener climbed the stairs to the nursery and found J. A. Cathcart cupping his eldest daughter's heart in his hands as tenderly as he would a wounded bird. The prosecution reconstructed the crime for the jury, with floor plans and photographs and an inexorable attention to detail, and I read it all compulsively in the newspapers. Mr. Cathcart had started with his wife. The experts disagreed about whether she had been awake or asleep when the first blow fell, but she had still been alive and screaming when his 10th blow severed the major vessels in her neck and very nearly decapitated her. She was dead when he dismembered her and tucked her butchered body carefully into bed. Then he went up to the nursery. Laura Donaghy, the children's nurse, tried to stop him and was smashed aside. The prosecution submitted as evidence Laura Donaghy's nightdress with the bloody print of a man's bare foot on the shoulder, where Mr. Cathcart had braced himself to yank the hatchet out of her head. Amazingly, the blow did not kill her immediately. At some point after Mr. Cathcart left her, she staggered to her feet, down two flights of stairs, leaving bloody handprints on the wall with every step, and out the front door, where she collapsed and died in the driveway. The youngest Cathcart daughter, Louisa, had the room closest to the stairs. He started there and worked his way back, Louisa, then Constance, then across the hall to John Aloysius Jr., where he lingered, hacking his son's body into unidentifiable meat, and then to his eldest daughter, Rose's room, where he was found. No one knew what had caused the roaring noise, a fact which made both prosecution and defense very uneasy. It was of no earthly use to ask J.A. Cathcart, because as far as he was concerned, he had had no part in his family's deaths at all. At his trial, and for the rest of his life, John Aloysius Cathcart insisted he was innocent. No one believed him. At the trial, no one even believed that he believed his own story, that he had woken up in bed next to his wife's dead body and raced upstairs only to find his children murdered as well. But after the trial, after his conviction, he deluged the world with letters insisting that the evidence had been faked, the witnesses suborned, that someone had gotten away with the murder of two women and four children. As the years passed, his theories became wilder and wilder. By the time he died, he was insisting that his wife was not dead, that the body in the bed had been someone else, that Helen Redding Cathcart was hiding in fear for her life in the attic of Third Hopscarp. He died begging the prison doctor to find her and protect her, and so convincing was his belief that the doctor actually organized a search party. They found nothing. I was met at the train station in Pittmanville by a silent, broad-shouldered colored man in a chauffeur's uniform. The only time we spoke on the way to Third Hop Scarp was when he sneezed. I said, "God bless you," and he said, "Thank you." We drove endlessly through the peaceful, bucolic countryside, and then turned and drove up an equally endless driveway through a dark and tangled forest, as if we were driving into a story from the Brothers Grimm, finally coming out where the driveway made a circle in front of Third Hop Scarp. The house was in the Gothic Revival style and had a tall central building with two relatively stubby wings and an addition to the end of the south wing that, while in the same style, did not entirely assimilate with the house as a whole. To the right of the front doors was an enormous bay window, and I found it distressing that there was not an answering bay window to the left, when the house was otherwise perfectly symmetrical. Marcus Oleander was waiting on the front steps, tall, as lean as Shakespeare's Cassius, with pale blonde hair and gleaming, glinting eyes, and greeted me, waving away the butler, with such relentless cordiality as to make me extremely nervous. He insisted on giving me a tour of the main house, including Zenobia Webster Tull's combination study and parlor, with its massive bay window and delicate ivy trellis wallpaper. Oleander assured me it had been restored to match contemporary descriptions in every photograph he could find. One of the photographs hung in an ornate frame over her desk, showing a stout, fashionable, white-haired lady with a malignant eye. Oleander clearly enjoyed playing tour guide, showing off his expensive toys to a less fortunate child. And for a while, I despaired of ever being freed from his hospitality. But when he finally led me down the hall through the south wing to the library, he explained the situation clearly enough. The case was that Marcus Oleander had recently inherited the libraries of two English friends of his and had had them shipped from London to Third Hop Scarp. Both gentlemen had been fanatical but hopelessly chaotic bibliophiles of an esoteric bent. Neither collection had a full catalog, and the problem was exacerbated by both the library of T. Zacharias Tull, which Mr. Oleander had acquired with Third Hop Scarp, and by his own library, the catalog of which, he said with another expansive, gleaming smile, was several years out of date.
"I'm afraid I'm much better at the collecting than the cataloging, Mr. Booth."
Most people are. He laughed as if I had said something amusing.
"I'm sure that's true. In any event, while I know there must be redundant volumes, I have no idea how to go about finding them, or..."
He trailed off and shrugged in a way that I was perhaps meant to find charming. "I understand," I said hastily, before he felt it necessary to charm me further. You realize, that is, this may be a very lengthy process."
"I should think so," he said, laughing again. "I appreciate you surrendering your long weekend like this, and I was hoping you might be willing to do so again, from time to time until the job is done. You will not find Third Hop Scarp's hospitality stingy or begrudging."
I'm sure I...
"Splendid," said Mr. Oleander, as if the matter were settled. "And here's the library."
He opened the door onto an oddly shaped, glassed-in porch and laughed at my expression.
"Originally, the library was entirely separate from the main house. But as Mr. Tull got older, he got more particular. First a roof, then screens, and finally the glass. Here's the library."
He pushed open a set of beautifully carved double doors and waved me through. The library, which T. Zacharias Tull had added to the house after his mother's death, was a long room, no doubt deliberately reminiscent of a cathedral nave. The tall, narrow windows that marked each of the seven aisles were stained glass. Uninspired, but attractive. Wall sconces flanked each window, refitted clumsily for electricity. Even when Oleander turned them on, the room remained dim and thick with shadows. There were books everywhere, on shelves, on the floor, still in crates with the lids pried off like clamshells. The three partial catalogs were on the table in front of the doors, along with a pile of bound ledgers and several stacks of index cards.
"I can see you are panting to get to your work," Mr. Oleander said behind me, making me jump. I had forgotten he was there. "I shan't detain you any longer. There's a bell pull by the door. Ring if you need anything, and feel free to wander the house and grounds. We dine at 8.
With that, he sauntered out, pulling the doors closed behind him. I spent the rest of the afternoon in a preliminary survey of the terrain, as it were, reading the shelves and digging through the open crates. Most of what I found on the shelves was unremarkable. Histories, including Gibbon, Macaulay, and Burke. Biographies, including Aubrey and Boswell. 18th-century novels, Elizabethan plays, the complete works of Mrs. Gaskell. I spotted a few items that looked promising, though. Uttinger, Macropoulos, a very battered copy of Bevington's Bestiary. All the books in the crates were more promising still. There were another 3 crates along the wall to the right of the doors, but I needed a crowbar to open them. At 7:15, I took myself off to walk in the grounds for 30 minutes before going to dress for dinner. A period of quiet reflection. While it would not make the ordeal of dining with Marcus Oleander any less dreadful, might give me strength to withstand it. I walked as far as the ornamental lake to the northeast of the house. Although, in general, I admire and enjoy the use of water in landscaping, I had to admit that this particular execution of the idea had perhaps been a mistake. The lake, for it was just slightly too large to call a pond, seemed curiously swollen, turbid, and much too still. The smell of stagnation and decay was as heavy as a pall. And there was nothing, not a noise, not a motion, to suggest that anything lived here. But at the same time, there was an oppressive feeling, not just of being watched, but almost of being stalked, as if I were perhaps only a single wrong step away from being caught by something both cruel and hungry. I did not linger, returning to the better maintained and more pleasant parts of the garden. I was walking through the formal elegance of the rose garden, pleasing, even though nothing was in bloom, when a voice said, "You're the librarian, aren't you?" I turned, and the speaker emerged from the shadow of a trellised arbor. He was a boy, 16 or 17 at most, tall, coltish, but not as gawky as I had been at his age. As I still was. Under straight, rather heavy eyebrows, his eyes were brilliant and dark as night. His voice was deep, although I guessed only recently broken, and his elocution had the excellence of careful training. I said, "I am an archivist, yes."
"Is there a difference?"
I explained, and when I had done, as if I had passed some sort of test, he extended his hand.
"Alexis Rigby."
I shook his hand quickly and reluctantly. "Kyle Murchison Booth."
"Charmed," he said.
I turned away from his brilliant stare and said rather desperately, "Are you a member of Mr. Oleander's, what, the OAA? No, I thank you. They're a little ridiculous, don't you think, prancing about in their mystic bedsheets?" The Order Aurori Eterni favored the Greek in their ceremonial garb. This information, too, had been in the newspapers because Marcus Oleander made sure everything was. I recalled some very unflattering photographs. "You, sound like a skeptic," I said. "Even a youth would be a welcome ally." "No," he said. And his smile shocked me, for it was both sly and terribly weary. "I wouldn't say that." He wanted me to ask, I was uncertain whether I wished to oblige him, having learned long ago that once one agreed, even tacitly, even unwittingly, to that sort of game, one was as hopelessly ensnared as a foolish thrashing fly in a spider's web. Before I found a reply that would be both polite and noncommittal, the brazen voice of a gong spoke across the garden.
"Half an hour till dinner," said Alexis Rigby.
"You'd best go change clothes."
"Yes," I said, and I fled from him in long strides across the dusk-drowned garden to the house. I do not like spiritualism. Its practitioners are mostly frauds. Those who are sincere are frequently also lamentably misguided. Children playing with knives and matches. There are exceptions, but the unscrupulous and the naive are far more common. And the nature of my work is such that I encounter them far more often than I would wish to. Marcus Oleander oozed fraud from every golden scale. Most of those at his dinner table that evening were gulls, as the Elizabethans would have called them, entering into their own fleecing with self-important enthusiasm. Counting myself, there were 12, with our host an oppressively jovial 13th. Conversation in the early part of the meal was devoted to slandering an absent 14th. Mr. Paul Meridew had sent a telegram saying he was unavoidably detained, but the consensus at the table was that he had, in the bluff military language of Captain Theodore Blackburn, funked it. Captain Blackburn and his wife Myra were the guardians of Alexis Rigby. They were not members of the Order, and they were not gulls. I suspected strongly that they were charlatans every bit as adroit as Marcus Oleander. They certainly knew how to gild the lily they had in Alexis Rigby, who I gathered was a medium already attracting a great deal of attention in occult circles. It was, or at least Myra Blackburn made it sound as if it were, something of a coup for Mr. Oleander to have gotten him to Third Hop Scarp, and the Order fawned accordingly. Alexis himself remained exquisitely polite, although he did not quite bother to hide how tedious he found it all. He seemed a different person from the one I had met in the garden. Smoother, stiller, darker. Too much like the ornamental lake, I thought, watching Alexis listen indifferently as Mr. Oleander flattered him and controlled a shiver. It was not a happy thought. I noticed that Mr. Oleander was the cynosure of all feminine eyes, except possibly the calculating ones of Myra Blackburn. Miss Parrington, who had greeted me brightly and then forgotten about me, was by no means the worst, and my neck and ears burned with vicarious mortification. It was cruel of Mr. Oleander to encourage them, but I saw no recognition of that cruelty in the married men around the table. The other unmarried man, Michael Kitchener, was Mr. Oleander's lieutenant, stocky and dark, with a sharp widow's peak and an equally sharp smile. He was prominent in the assassination of Paul Meridew's character, and it was he, having become bored with this pastime, who said over the roast pork with apples and chestnuts, "Well, really, it isn't as if all is lost. What about you, Mr. Booth?" He caught me utterly unprepared. I said, choked, and sought refuge in my water glass. Mr. Oleander said, "Michael, that's not fair. I'm sure Mr. Booth has no interest in our foolish little forays after knowledge." As a tactical move, it was perhaps a little blatant for Machiavelli, but then again, perhaps not. It was unquestionably effective, for everyone instantly focused on me like hunting dogs given a scent. I shrank back from the evangelical light in the women's eyes and said hastily, "I have no opinion."
"Oh, but you should, Mr. Booth," Mr. Oleander said.
I looked up just in time to catch his smirk.
"You should join us for the seance tomorrow evening."
"No," I said, far more sharply than I intended, and therefore added placatingly, "Thank you."
"You shouldn't reject something you have no knowledge of," Mrs. Hallett said.
I should think a librarian would understand the importance of being open-minded.
Mr. Booth informs me that the correct term is archivist,
Alexis Rigby said.
Smooth and dark, twisting information shared into pedantry, twisting understanding into mockery.
The company followed his lead like sheep after a bellwether. I was unsurprised. I held mulishly, miserably to my refusal, and escaped as soon as I could. I had brought with me my favorite collection of Clemence Renard's poetry, Les Cieux d'Anne Boleyn, and once I had performed my evening ablutions, I settled in to read. I had no expectation of sleeping, and I was certainly wide awake when I finished Les Prières de la Pluie. But I remember being in the middle of Le Roi du Place Sombre, just as the mad narrator cries, Soulez-moi, moi, c'est le champion des ombres. And then I was somewhere else. I was trapped in a windowless, doorless, airless room. It was black and suffocating. The walls were smooth, unyielding plaster. I shouted, then screamed and pounded on the walls until my hands were slick with blood and I was choking for breath, but no one came. I knew, the way one does know things in dreams, that there were people nearby, but they did not hear me. Worse, as the night wore on, I knew that even if they heard me, they did not care. I was trapped there all night, unable to free myself, until the merciful sunlight across my closed eyes dazzled me awake. I did not expect the Order Aurora Eterni to be early risers, and they were not. My only company at the breakfast table was Miss Parrington. She was all twigs and cobwebs and the mindless chatter of a wind chime. It was restful, though, because she did not expect me to answer her. Tremendous self-absorption can sometimes be almost the same as tact. She told me a great deal about her own occult experiences and asked not a single question about mine. I was grateful to escape without meeting anyone else, and it was with difficulty that I resisted the impulse to lock the doors of the library behind me. I was left in peace all morning, making steady, if glacial, progress on the task of writing catalog cards for each of the books physically present in the library. The hopeful delusions of the catalogs could wait. I emerged, dust-streaked and ink-blotched for lunch, and the Order Aurora Eterni and their guests eyed me with sidelong amusement. Since the table was deeply involved in a discussion of the correct rules under which to play croquet, I was spared conversational gambits. I only wished I could have brought my work with me. I was opening the doors to the library, already and gratefully planning my afternoon's tasks, when Alexis Rigby called my name. I closed the doors without entering and turned to face him.
Aren't you, playing croquet?
Oh, in a moment. Will you come to the séance tonight?
I don't know, the occult doesn't. That is, it is not a subject that holds much interest for me.
No, he said, as if he saw falsehood plainly on my face. Not as you understand it, no.
His eyebrows went up.
I beg your pardon, I didn't mean to hit a nerve.
Oh, of course you did, I thought.
I did not say it.
After a moment, he continued lightly, And in any event, please don't tar me with the OAA's brush. Their drivel certainly isn't what I understand as the occult either. The way he spoke, so much as one adult expert to another, worried me.
How long have you been a medium?
All my life, he said with a dazzlingly sunny smile.
I meant, how long have you been, giving seances?
Since I was 13 or so.
And your guardians don't object?
Myra's my teacher.
Ah,
I said. Now even more worried. But we heard Myra Blackburn's voice calling.
Alexis, darling, where have you wandered off to?
And Alexis said,
Whoops. Duty calls.
He strode away, strong and arrogant as a young god, and I, dusty, shabby, no longer young even if I ever had been, returned to the library. The cataloging proceeded sedately. The only progress I made on my true task at Third Hop Scarp was the discovery of a copy of Isaiah Hope Turnbull's forgery.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?